How Lady Can Step Up Their Response to the Clergy Sexual Abuse Crisis in the Diocese of Buffalo. Part 2 of the 6-part series. Accountability is a Fundamental Expectation. Upon hearing details about an abuse case the diocese tried to cover for 14 years, a state sex offender investigator for the Attorney General expressed shock and abhorrence. Upon hearing the same details, a huge segment of our diocesan lay advisors to the bishop responded with peevish silence. Surely we can all agree that clergy, especially those who agree to take on responsibility as diocesan officials, must be above reproach and demonstrate unassailable moral and professional conduct. After all, they reflect the person of Christ in all they say and do, including how they conduct the affairs of the church. Not holding them accountable for their decisions and actions would certainly be a doomed strategy to instill trust in the diocese, not to mention maintain the integrity of its operation. If we do not have faith in the integrity of the people in this system, how can we have faith in the system itself and what it produces? And if credibly accused bad actors are not handled appropriately and responsibly, the entire standard of operation is called into question. Let's examine this idea of accountability through the lens of one case. This. Now I'm going to play audio of an embedded video in this post. This is part of WKBW's report that aired September 5th, 2019. It's about 5 minutes.
Father Richard Biernat was just 23 years old when he arrived in the Diocese of Buffalo in 2003.
During that break, Father Art Smith assaulted me sexually. And I wish somebody told me it was a crime.
Richard was a seminarian and a recent immigrant of Poland and says he didn't know how to process what had just happened.
At that time, I was just, I knew enough English to order latte at Starbucks, not to report the sexual assault, you know? They don't teach you these words in English second language classes.
This document Bishop Malone sent to the Vatican confirms Father Richard's account, though Smith denies the allegations. Father Richard says he reported the sexual assault to Auxiliary Bishop Edward Grosch, who he says blamed him for not locking his own door at the rectory.
And then he says it was my fault because I'd not locked the door. Should have locked the door. And was Father Art Smith drunk? Because if he was, maybe he did not know what he was doing.
Then came this chilling statement, according to Richard, by Bishop Malone's right-hand man.
And then he said, and Richard, if you don't stop talking about this, you will not become a priest. You understand me? That was so hurtful, so difficult. That meeting, I thought destroyed my life for years. It sent me into depression, into anxiety attacks.
So you are reporting a crime here, yes. And you're being made to feel by the leaders of the diocese like you're the one that did something wrong.
Yes, but the other thing you have to realize, this was only my second year in a foreign country. I did not know the laws here, and I was turning to church for help. And then they re-victimized me again.
That's just pure blackmail. And that happened repeatedly by Bishop Gross.
Father Richard's attorney, Barry Covert, says the threat was clear.
And the implication being you won't be ordained, you will be then sent back to your home country because you won't be on a student visa, you'll be taken right out of the country.
Documents show Father Richard, because of his position as vice chancellor, was even required to notarize documents for Bishop Malone that allowed Smith, Father Richard's own alleged abuser, to be placed back into ministry by Malone, despite other allegations of misconduct.
How did it make you feel then to have to, as Bishop Malone's secretary, sign off on these letters putting Aaron Smith back in ministry.
How many times I had said in the senior staff, abuse is abuse. You know, age doesn't matter.
Father Richard says when he saw how the diocese was handling sexual harassment complaints by a seminarian about Father Jeffrey Nowak, he decided to come forward because he didn't want to see another seminarian silenced. He became a U.S. citizen this July, a fact not lost on Bishop Malone in the secret audio recordings, where the bishop pressures Father Richard to stay quiet about Nowak.
Don't forget what I'm saying. We can't, please don't get into that. Yeah. I can't, you're an American citizen. You're free to do what you want.
I bolted out of my chair, and because I realized that was verbal confirmation that my client was being indeed directly, or at a minimum indirectly, being blackmailed by the diocese to not disclose his abuse.
The final indignity came this year when Father Richard says a prominent Catholic wrote a letter to the Bishop's Council of the Laity urging the group to push the bishop for answers in Richard's case because, quote, we cannot possibly heal without truth.
What was Bishop Malone's and Bishop Gross's, what was their response to her letter?
Bishop Malone wanted me to call her to say that I'm okay, that, you know, everything is fine.
Now, as you watch this video, please stop the timeline at 3:11 and spend a moment looking at his face. This is your front row seat to pain, embarrassment, shame, guilt, betrayal, and loss of dignity that are as real and raw as they were when I first talked to Father Richard Biernot about his tragedy in 2006. If you did not watch that brief video, please do so now, or you will not understand what I'm about to write. The case you witnessed in the video reflects the devastating effects of diocesan abuse upon an individual by chancery officials, seminary officials, and the bishops, many still alive and working in the diocese in the fall of 2018. The same time, 60 Minutes revealed Siobhan O'Connor as the whistleblower who released secret diocesan documents exposing corruption and cover-up of clergy sexual abuse crimes like this one and others. This is not a case that happened, quote-unquote, decades ago, as Bishop Richard Malone repeatedly tried to frame this entire crisis. In this post, we look at accountability for such atrocities with the expectation that laity, particularly those chosen to advise our bishops, should hold diocesan officials accountable for their actions or decisions or omissions in performing their duties. After the 60 Minutes story aired, six longtime Buffalo area lay advisors to the bishop, along with three other Buffalo area laywomen competent in their respective fields, announced the formation of an independent lay initiative to help come up with a plan for reform to help heal the diocese and restore trust. After months of rolling news stories revealing the extent of horrific clergy sexual abuse and diocesan cover-up of those crimes, who could not be edified by the group's very name, the Movement to Restore Trust? Now, this is the first time any one of the 311 official lay advisors to our bishop spoke up publicly, a full 8 months after Michael Whalen provided the spark to the crisis with the public disclosure of his tragic case as a teenager at the hands of a self-admitted serial child sexual molester priest. The media conference announcing the formation of the MRT was held indoors in a warm, respectable environment, as opposed to the chilly outdoor environment Whalen had no choice but to use. At the MRT's conference, someone in the audience naively asked if they were going to work with Siobhan O'Connor, former administrative assistant to the bishop, now internationally recognized as a lay Catholic, quote-unquote, hero, as CBS's Gail King described her. The lay leaders on the dais looked at each other and demurred to answer outright. what should have been our first clue that something was awry. Following the MRT's November 2018 announcement, the nine Buffalo area leaders said they worked for 10 weeks in collaboration with about 150 unnamed and admittedly quote-unquote amateur volunteer laity to ultimately come up with recommendations for the diocese. During the time they deliberated, I thought perhaps these prestigious Catholics leading the movement to restore trust, along with all those 287 laity who had been advising the bishop on the Bishop's Council of the Laity, would be interested in hearing from a different side of the clergy sexual abuse story. Most of the MRT leadership core had been on the BCL for literally decades, so my letter mailed to their homes in January 2019 covered them. That's the letter discussed at the end of the video. Well, one thing was certain. Diocesan officials would never have told those 287 laity about this case. Siobhan O'Connor had disclosed documents publicly exposing for the first time the crime against the seminarian and the cover-up. I offered a peek behind the curtain for them to see a hidden side of this case and the system of diocesan operations, with some officials still working for the diocese today, not decades ago. So they could see the character of the diocesan officials in whom they place so much trust, the depths of depravity some of them would plunge to keep the seminarian from talking, including threats, shield their friends, protect the reputation of the diocese, follow orders, or safeguard their careers. Surely the collective conscience of these prestigious laity could be pricked to at least question the integrity of some of these officials as the MRT formulated plans for reform. Months later, we found out about the reprehensible manner in which my report was actually handled. The video testimony you just watched covered the bishop's responses, but the laity to whom it was sent for their reflection and aid in their pursuit of truth blithely passed it on to Bishop Malone. With the exception of one lone couple on the Bishop's Council of Laity who contacted me with a thank you message before quitting that organization, the 285 other lay advisors to Malone were apparently okay with the way my report was handled. Evidence, no doubt, of their tenure in the toxic culture of the Diocese of Buffalo. Quitasit consented. Silence means consent. Now, it's important to note, Bishop Malone did not deny the validity of a single allegation I made. Well, a couple of months after receiving my report, in early March that year, the Movement to Restore Trust announced its preliminary recommendations at a symposium held at Canisius College. Dr. Hurley stated those, quote, recommendations are based in many cases on perceptions of what is occurring in the diocese, unquote. Regrettably, the areas of inquiry in their report did not begin to touch some of the grave circumstances that surely needed to be addressed, revealed in my report in that one case alone in which I offered facts, documentation, and witness testimony, not quote-unquote perceptions, to help inform their recommendations. Now, following the peevish silence from the lay advisors, I contacted the New York State Attorney General's office to report the 2003 sexual assault perpetrated by a priest upon a seminarian. I provided not only my witness corroboration of the leaked reports already out there on this alleged crime, but testimony about the threats the victim reported to me, which were not in the leaked documentation, just as I had done for the 287 lay advisors. I suspected the AG wasn't aware of this alleged sexual assault because the diocese never filed a report with civil authorities, never filed a report with the Diocesan Review Board, and never even mentioned it to the diocesan attorney. The victim filed his report with the diocese in the spring of 2004, a few weeks after the alleged crime. Chancery officials, including Monsignor Robert Cunningham, who was the diocesan administrator at the time, Auxiliary Bishop Edward Grosch, and subsequent bishops and diocesan officials to the present day, ignored the report, according to the victim. And I wanted the AG to know of its existence. Now, these are all verifiable facts to which the diocesan attorney, Terry Connors, can attest today. Chew on this quote. The auxiliary bishop actually threatened the seminarian to keep him from reporting the crime? The investigator on the phone gasped. Keep in mind, she serves in the Attorney General's Sex Offender Management Bureau. I didn't think much could shock an investigator in her position, but this revelation apparently did. After our lengthy interview, the inspector thanked me with no little sincerity for having the quote-unquote courage to come forward. I wasn't courageous. I was ticked off. For 16 years, this young man had to live under the tyranny of official diocesan cover-up as a seminarian, and then as a priest, watching his abuser get off scot-free along with the bishops and chancery and seminary officials who covered this alleged crime. But he said that was nothing compared to how he felt after hearing that his abuser chalked up two more sexual predatory incident reports with innocent victims after the Vice Chancellor, Monsignor David LaPuma, under Bishop Malone, coordinated the placement of the alleged sexual molester as chaplain at an adult care facility in 2012. Well, this is part of Malone's effort to put Art Smith back into ministry after his predecessor mothballed Smith a few months earlier. And over the years, all those with knowledge of or involved in the cover-up of the alleged sexual molestation of the seminarian in 2003 retained their positions in the diocese. Some even received prestigious assignments or have sailed off into retirements free of any consequences, duly lauded for their service. Well, the optics are clear. Crime does indeed pay. As shocked and appalled as the AG investigator was at hearing about the diocese's response to the alleged crime against their own seminarian, how do you think Father Richard felt to have this report handled so coldly by quote-unquote respected and quote-unquote prestigious laity and responded to in such a demeaning fashion in bouncing my report to the, quote, diocese, with his tormentor, Bishop Grosch, to his face in front of Bishop Malone, shamefully denying that he made the alleged 2004 threats to keep that seminarian quiet. Talk about putting your cigarette out on someone's soul. Here were two bishops engaged in horrendous abuse of authority over a subordinate and a clergy sexual abuse survivor. And our lay advisors to Bishop Malone apparently condone this, given their silence on the subject to this day? You can't make this up. The callousness on display from the lay advisors to the diocesan officials, to the former seminary rector, to the bishops in that chancery room last January should cause every single one of us to cry out to God for mercy. God help us all. It seems objectively clear. The incident in the Chancery Building in late January 2019 certainly reveals much about not only the nature of diocesan culture, but the nature of the relationship between our entrenched Buffalo area lay advisors and diocesan officials. As I stated in my letter to the Bishop's Council of Laity, my intent was for them to absorb the information and reflect upon it for their deliberations in advising the bishop, not bounce pass it on to the, quote, diocese. I already informed them in the letter that it had been duly reported through the seminary. Now, when industry executives, a president of a Catholic college, medical executives, judges, lawyers, a television news investigative journalist, and various other highly qualified and respected members of the BCL do not offer a squeak of a response or even acknowledgement of a receipt to a legitimate report addressing the heart of this clergy sexual abuse crisis, we naturally ask, who or what are they trying to protect? Curiously, according to the MRT reform proposals, they actually do support laity coming forth with information on bishops' behavior. So how do we reconcile the treatment of my report with this statement in the reform proposals under the report heading, quote-unquote, monitoring bishops, where we read, and I quote, members of the laity may be well positioned to identify serious problems with the conduct of a bishop once in office. The laity can have valuable information about a bishop's abuse behavior, not solely sex abuse, or financial mismanagement or corruption, unquote. Well, the hypocrisy with the way my report was handled vis-a-vis this statement is astounding. Some have argued that we can read exactly what's going on in the relationship between entrenched lay advisors and diocesan officials within the very documents the MRT produced that spring and summer. Recommended quote-unquote accountability measures are only directed to future bishops. We do not read any clear statements about accountability for diocesan officials still alive and some at work today, tainted with credible allegations of covering up clergy sex abuse cases or other forms of corruption. That MRT officials were attempting to quote-unquote provide a lifeline to Bishop Malone was openly acknowledged by the MRT's de facto leader, Dr. Hurley, at the March 9th symposium in 2019. Well, this is not to dismiss the entirety of the MRT committee's full report, which contains many solid and worthwhile recommendations. But what's the point of drafting pages of ideas to, quote unquote, assess progress against defined metrics, when the agents of corruption are left in place with no accountability, and bishops are not challenged to examine cases and use their authority to pass moral judgment as they have done with Father Richard? Consequently, we are supposed to rely upon the very officials who participated in taking this diocese down its destructive path to lead it out, with the help of MRT lay leaders, of course. Accountability is inherent with any office a priest accepts. Laity cannot ignore this fundamental expectation. So let's revisit our goal to establish trust in the diocese. If the first breach of trust was with clergy sexual abuse victims, the second breach of trust was with we unsuspecting laity who trust our administrators to follow the teachings of Jesus Christ and His church, follow the law, assist victims, protect the public, and appropriately and justly hold accountable the diocesan officials among them who broke that trust. The third breach of trust was also with we unsuspecting laity who trust our lay advisors to at least make an attempt to hold these officials accountable for their actions and decisions, which caused us to lose our trust in the diocese. Clergy who take on the enormous responsibility of leadership roles in our diocese should also understand they own the effects of their decisions, and that includes decisions not only to give unjust, illegal, or immoral orders, but to follow them as well. If they want the prestige, the perks, the tailored suits, the upgraded housing, the titles of office, diocesan officials also have to accept the consequences of their choices, especially in how they handled sex abuse cases. Despite consensus of diocesan senior staff that the bishop was engaging in ongoing cover-up of sexual misconduct by a diocesan priest, along with that priest's alleged violation of the seal of confession, Father Richard broke ranks with their collective enabling. In whistleblowing this grave misconduct of the bishop, he chose to follow the law, his moral conscience, and moral principles in accord with that last line of canon law, the law that supersedes all other church laws. And because of that, last December, Bishop Malone suspended Father Richard's priestly faculties for revealing that bishop's ongoing cover-up of sexual misconduct by a diocesan priest, along with that priest's alleged violation of the seal of confession. Not long after Bishop Scharfenberger assumed his responsibilities in Buffalo, he said Father Richard, the whistleblower priest who is also a victim of clergy sexual abuse, would have to show, quote-unquote, accountability for his actions before he would reinstate him in priestly ministry. You can't make this up. Transformation of diocesan culture begins with a personal gut check of every individual who agrees to the enormous responsibility he or she assumes on behalf of innocent laity. Let us keep praying our daily rosary. Our Lady, Queen of the Church and Hope of Abuse Survivors, pray for us. Postscript. The next post, part three of this six-part series, further examines the notion of accountability in the clergy sexual abuse crisis in the context of enabling tactics used by bishops and their lay advisors, which prevent them from holding accountable diocesan officials and the abusers they protect. More dark corners in the diocese revealed to illustrate how this works. Now, if you have any contributions to make in this dialogue on this series, please post them in the comments box on this web post or the contact page of this website, laydob.com. Thank you for reading this series, and may God bless you.